Hello there. Today is Wednesday, July 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, despite leaked private conversations dissing President Trump, the UK says it will not remove its ambassador.
Sometimes things that you have to say to your friends that you'd rather not say, like I said to President Trump today, because I think his comments about Theresa May were unacceptable, and I don't think he should have made them.
A new Secret Service study offers clues about why people commit mass murders. Also ahead, a Detroit street is named after the Queen of Soul. It's all on today's International Edition. Top U.S. officials say Iran should not test America's patience as the Islamic Republic creates nuclear material in quantities and purity above limits set in the 2015 international nuclear deal. The reaction came as the International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors verified that Iran did breach the limit set in the nuclear deal aimed at restraining Tehran's nuclear weapons development. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has more from Washington.
Iran says it will violate the 2015 Iran nuclear accord after the U.S. withdrew from it last year. That sparked a stern warning from Vice President Mike Pence.
Iran should not confuse American restraint with a lack of American resolve. We hope for the best, but the United States of America and our military are prepared to protect our interests and protect our personnel and our citizens in the region. We will continue to oppose Iran's malign influence. We will continue to bring pressure on their economy. And under President Donald Trump, America will never allow Iran to obtain a nuclear weapon.
National Security Advisor John Bolton had a similar warning to Tehran.
We will continue to increase the pressure on the Iranian regime until it abandons its nuclear weapons program and ends its violent activities across the Middle East, including conducting and supporting terrorism around the world.
A top Iranian army chief said Monday his country is not looking for war with any country. But Iran is calling on other signatories to the Iran nuclear deal to find a way around the crippling U.S. economic sanctions, including on crucial oil exports. The European Union and Russia expressed concern about Iran's uranium enrichment action. But Russia also blamed the U.S. for withdrawing from the nuclear deal last year. Cindy Sain, VOA News, Washington.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. South Sudan is marking an anniversary with hunger still a pressing issue. The U.S. urges Turkey to stop oil drilling off of Cyprus. Trump will look very carefully at Labor Secretary's role in prosecuting a child sex trafficking case. And widespread obesity makes Trump's military recruitment goals a challenge. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Human rights activists are rejecting Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam's assurances that an effort to amend an extradition bill was dead on Tuesday. Lam, in an address to media Tuesday morning, didn't make clear if the legislation was being withdrawn as protesters have demanded, or did make clear.
There are still lingering doubts about the government's sincerity or worries whether the government will restart the process in the Legislative Council. So I reiterate here, there is no such plan. The bill is dead.
Well, the bill sparked massive demonstrations from the moment it was introduced in April, with opponents alarmed about extraditing criminal suspects to China, which has a substantially different legal system than Hong Kong. But protesters are now making a new demand. They want an independent probe into police abuse against protesters in recent demonstrations. VOA Asia's Ira Melman asks Richard Bush, senior fellow at the Brookings Institute, if he thinks the protests will just keep going on.
Well, it certainly looks like they're going to continue. They have a head of steam behind them, and they were successful. In my personal view, I think that the protesters should declare victory and go home, particularly after the invasion of the Legislative Council complex. I think that they're losing some support in the public, and if Carrie Lam says it's dead, it really is dead. They should just take her word for it.
What does this do as far as the overall scenario of the relationship between mainland China, between Beijing and Hong Kong?
The extradition bill, when it was put forward, I think reconfirmed for skeptical people in Hong Kong that the rule of law and the independence of the judiciary, which was a promise that Beijing made to the people of Hong Kong before it reverted back to China, and which it kept for almost 20 years, that promise is seriously in doubt. So it deepens the mistrust between a lot of people in Hong Kong on the one hand and the government in Beijing and the Hong Kong government on the other. How that can be put back together, I don't know. I hope that China understands that the best thing it could do at this point is to reaffirm the promises it made and act on those promises.
Speaking of promises, the one you are talking about, is that in danger right now? What have you heard from the Beijing government authorities that might put it in jeopardy, the agreements made between mainland China and Hong Kong?
Beijing is faced with a dilemma. It doesn't like instability. It seems to have convinced itself that the United States was behind all this trouble. And yet it is doing very little to try and regain the trust and confidence and promote the welfare of Hong Kong people.
What else do the protesters want, and now do they stand any chance whatsoever of getting what they want?
The underlying issue here, I think, is movement towards full democracy in Hong Kong, not just the protection of civil and political rights and the rule of law, which Hong Kong promised, but election of all major leaders of the Hong Kong government. Democracy is about checks and balances. Hong Kong's incomplete democracy means that going to the street is the best check and best balance that the public has.
What do you think of so far of the U.S. reaction to all of this, as well as other nations around the world?
Well, for the U.S., this, I think, is probably viewed as a David and Goliath story, with Goliath being Big Bag China and David being the protesters in the street. And in this round, David won.
That is Richard Bush, senior fellow at the Brookings Institute, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. U.S. President Donald Trump Tuesday called British Ambassador Kim DeRoche a very stupid guy, a new taunt aimed at undercutting the envoy's assessment that Trump is inept and incompetent. VOA Asia's Latika Hoke has more.
The diplomatic kerfuffle was caused by leaked confidential reports Ambassador Kim Darroch had cabled to London, in which he described Trump's White House as dysfunctional, unpredictable, and inept. Trump promptly responded that we will no longer deal with him. But the State Department said Tuesday its dealings with the British Embassy in Washington have not changed.
We will continue to deal with all accredited individuals until we get any further guidance from the White House or the President, which we will, of course, abide by the President's direction.
Darroch withdrew from a planned White House visit on Tuesday following Trump's fresh barrage of tweets in which he called the British envoy wacky and stupid and reportedly a pompous fool. He also said Prime Minister Theresa May handled Brexit in a foolish way. British Secretary of State Jeremy Hunt, who is one of the candidates to replace the outgoing Prime Minister, called for respect from Britain's ally.
I made it clear that I don't share the ambassador's assessment of either the US administration or relations with the US administration. But I do defend his right to make that frank assessment, and it's very important that our diplomats all over the world continue to be able to do so.
The U.S. State Department says the diplomatic tiff will not affect U.S.-British ties.
We have an incredibly special and strategic relationship with the United Kingdom. That has gone on for quite a long time, and it's bigger than any individual. It's bigger than any government. It's something that has stood the test of time and will continue to do so.
Britain is expected to elect a new prime minister in the coming weeks, a development Trump has called good news for the wonderful United Kingdom. The country's next political leader may well send a new envoy to Washington. Meanwhile, Downing Street has ordered a mole hunt for the leaker and is working to prevent emergence of additional embarrassing cables. Zlatica Hoch, VOA News, Washington.
A Secret Service study finds telltale signs among people who carry out mass attacks. AP correspondent Tim McGuire has that.
The study done by the National Threat Assessment Center finds similarities among those who carried out attacks in 2018. They include nearly all of them making threats or concerning statements before their attacks. Two-thirds had mental health issues, most of the attackers were male, and a third of them had a history of domestic violence. The center says the study is designed for both law enforcement and civilians to be more aware to avert more attacks in the future.
That's Tim McGuire reporting. A federal appeals court says President Donald Trump can't ban critics from his Twitter account. That more from AP correspondent Shelley Adler.
A three-judge panel has agreed with a lower court judge who said President Trump violates the First Amendment when he blocks critics. The ruling came in a case brought by the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University. It had sued on behalf of seven people blocked by the president after they criticized his policies. The appeals court said the First Amendment does not permit a public official using a social media account to exclude people from an otherwise open online dialogue because they disagree with the official. I'm Shelley Adler.
Well, the survival of wild animals such as elephants and tigers are at risk, and one of the main reasons is poaching. These animals are being hunted for their body parts, such as tusks and skins. It's happening even in protected wildlife parks, but as VOA's Elizabeth Lee reports, park rangers may soon have a powerful new tool to help stop poaching.
Around the world, wildlife park rangers are at the forefront of protecting animals from being killed by poachers.
Poachers are very actively working in some of those protected areas, and many animals could potentially be killed because of it.
Computer scientist Bistra Dilkina is part of a team of University of Southern California researchers who are using artificial intelligence to help park rangers find the traps set by poachers before the animals get caught in them. A set of algorithms named Protection Assistant for Wildlife Security, or PAWS, uses information such as historic field data and satellite information to predict areas where poachers are more or less likely to set traps.
Our current models are basically able to predict 80% of the time the correct answer of whether there would be poaching activity in a particular area.
Dilkina tested PAWS in a wildlife sanctuary in Cambodia, an area more than three times larger than Los Angeles. With the help of artificial intelligence, rangers found more than 500 snares in 1 month, compared to the previous months when they found about 100.
So it was a fivefold increase in their ability to remove these snares, you know, hopefully before they're able to kill animals.
The team at the University of Southern California aims to integrate its software into an existing tool called SMART, or Spatial Monitoring and Reporting Tool, by 2020. SMART is used at more than 800 sites around the world where it allows rangers to collect, communicate, and analyze illegal activity. SMART would be more powerful with a predictive component, says Dilkina. Artificial intelligence combined with the experience of rangers will give animals faced with a threat of extinction a fighting chance. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.
VOA's International Edition continues. One of New York City's oldest and largest social service institutions that initially opened its door as a home for abandoned children with just $5 is celebrating its 150th year in operation. The mission of the New York Foundling has evolved with the needs of the community to deal with the most important social issues. And they now serve a 250,000 children and families, also immigrant families in crisis in New York and Puerto Rico. Joining us now to talk more about it and their big anniversary is the New York Foundling president and CEO Bill Baccalini. Wow, 150 years is a long time for a nonprofit to survive and actually grow to this degree. Tell us about how your mission has evolved from just taking in abandoned children.
I think what we've prided ourselves in over the years is staying responsive to the needs of contemporary time, and so it has evolved. Today, we still stand as one of the city's largest, but we do a full range of services, from Head Start services in Puerto Rico to services for the developmentally disabled throughout the city. So today, we're a $210 million organization with over 3,000 staff serving thousands of kids and families each year.
You're also helping communities of immigrants living in New York, in the general area. Is that correct?
Yes. We had a residential program here for 2 years, but we have since moved to more of a community-based effort with immigrant minors who have found themselves here in New York stuck in the middle in some respects.
It certainly seems relevant to what we've been seeing here in the United States, particularly obviously on the border in Texas. But the needs just seem so great everywhere.
Yes, no, the needs of these young kids. I mean, we ran a program, we had 30 young men, and just the looks on their faces, they didn't know what tomorrow would bring. So we put a roof over their heads, gave them some nurturing and warmth, and quickly hooked them up with caregiver relatives here in the States. But no, I don't think it's anything that any of us would want our adolescent children to be subjected to.
You also focus on the juvenile justice system.
We're big believers that as a country, we've overvalued incarceration and residential care. So we focus our efforts largely on community-based corrections. And just this year, we've been successful in getting 150 adolescents off of Rikers Island here in the city, providing them community-based services in lieu of incarceration. We have a waiting list for the program. The judges are very, very happy with the outcome, and we believe that community-based alternatives are much, much better long-term for both the community and the young person in question.
Even more so than adults, probably, they can really get caught up and sort of lost and entangled in the system, I would imagine.
Exactly, and let's face it, if a young person may make a decision at age 20 or 21 that is going to have ramification and consequences for them for the rest of their life, so if we can get to them before that, both the community and the young person are the beneficiaries.
Now, I know that you focus on New York City and the surrounding counties, but you are involved with helping families and children from Puerto Rico. How did that evolve?
Started in the mid-70s when a sister here in New York City went back, a Puerto Rican sister went back home to Puerto Rico to care for her dying mom, and while there started this small little program, and today We serve 1,500 kids in our Head Start program. We have over 400 staff all across the island in Puerto Rico and serve 1,500 children in early Head Start and Head Start. And it's a wonderful, I actually, you know, I don't say this to the New York staff, but we consider the Puerto Rico program to be perhaps our best-run program.
Are these people that were from Puerto Rico that have moved to New York, or are you expanding actually to communities in Puerto Rico?
Oh, no, we're in Puerto Rico. We have over 400 staff in Puerto Rico. We have 40 different sites on the island of Puerto Rico as far south as Cuomo. So we're actually in Puerto Rico. We have a very, okay. very big footprint there.
What are your plans for the future? Any new programs you feel like you're seeing need to get started?
We actually pride ourselves in being able to, we pay a lot of attention to evaluation, a lot of attention to the metric, and so we pride ourselves in anticipating the needs 4 to 6 years out. We have decided to double down on education. In the child welfare world, we believe this, beyond keeping kids safe, our greatest obligation to them is to make sure that they get an education. Sadly, only 1 in 5 kids aging out of care in New York City actually has a high school degree, and only 3% will ever get a college degree. That future is awfully bleak. 1 in 5 with a high school degree, 3% with a college degree. So we've really doubled down on education, from our one-of-its-kind charter school in the South Bronx to our supporting 125 kids residing on CUNY campuses in the city, to our one-on-one tutoring program where every young person in our care gets assigned a one-on-one tutor. We actually at the Foundling have been able to turn this 20% graduation rate to 92%, and we have 60% of our young people attending colleges. We think education is something that we have to really, really focus on, because we have to equip these kids to take care of themselves and their families going forward. And if we let them out into the world with 1 in 5 only having a high school degree, almost none of them having a college degree, the future is just not a very bright.
All right, that's New York Foundling President and CEO Bill Baccalini. Thank you for being with us. Michigan's governor has signed legislation honoring the late Queen of Soul with a highway designation. Governor Gretchen Whitmer on Monday approved the bill to designate a portion of M-10 in Detroit, Michigan as the Aretha L. Franklin Memorial Highway. Franklin died in Detroit last year after battling pancreatic cancer. The Democratic governor notes in a statement that Franklin's creativity and voice contributed to our musical and cultural history in Michigan. Supporters of the designation say dedicating a portion of the highway is a way to honor the musical and cultural icon who grew up in Detroit and learned the gospel fundamentals at New Bethel Baptist Church. Some Republicans did oppose the bill, however. They've said that such designations should only go to fallen first responders and military veterans. And you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
I drop the top, baby. I cruise on into it. It's better than Ella Street.
Hello, this is James Butte, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa Show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. Or you can call us on 001-202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. That's Daybreak Africa at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $10 million for information leading to the disruption of the financial mechanisms of the global terrorist organization Lebanese Hezbollah. Based in Lebanon, Hezbollah receives weapons, training, and funding from Iran, which the Secretary of State designated as a state sponsor of terrorism in 1984. Hezbollah generates about $1 billion a year from a combination of direct financial support from Iran, international businesses and investments, donor networks, and money laundering activities. The reward could be paid for information leading to the identification and disruption of Hezbollah's sources of revenue or its key financial facilitators, including major donors, financial institutions facilitating its transactions, businesses or investments owned or controlled by Hezbollah, front companies engaged in international procurement of dual-use technology on Hezbollah's behalf, and criminal schemes involving Hezbollah members or supporters, which benefit the terrorist organization. In addition to Hezbollah's global financial networks, the Rewards for Justice program is highlighting three individuals as examples of the type of key Hezbollah financiers or facilitators about whom it seeks information. They are Adham Tabaja, Mohammad Ibrahim Basi, and Ali Youssef Charara. Each has previously been designated by the U.S. Treasury Department as a specially designated global terrorist. Since its inception in 1984, the Rewards for Justice program has paid in excess of $150 million to more than 100 people who provided actionable information that helped bring terrorists to justice or prevented acts of international terrorism. If anyone has information on Hezbollah financial networks, please contact the Rewards for Justice office via the website at www.rewardsforjustice.net. Email lh@rewardsforjustice.net. Phone in North America at 1-800-877-3927. Or mail Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303, USA. Individuals may also contact the regional security officer at the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate. All information will be kept strictly confidential.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown.